Okay, I think it's just gone past 3 o'clock now, so we can start. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhang Tamang Sanghang Namasami. So for today's sutta, as you all may know, that every of these suttas is usually either put on YouTube or it's put on our website. So after so many years of doing this class, we've done most of them. So every now and again you have to look, what have I missed out? And one of the ones I missed out, one of the most obvious, was the very first teaching of the Buddha, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutra, the teaching which those of you who know the history of Buddhism, after the Buddha's enlightenment at Bodh Gaya, thinking about who would he teach, and a few of the most prominent suspects to teach had already passed away, so he thought of his first 5 disciples who had abandoned him when he started giving up his asceticism. And so that they, the Buddha thought, I can teach those. So he travelled to Benares, you know, which is maybe a month's walk or something. He travelled to Benares, and there he met his first 5 disciples. And of course, they rejected him at first, but then they saw that from his demeanour, he had obviously got something. And so he gave them this teaching, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutra, always known in all traditions as the first teaching of the newly enlightened Buddha, and basically put the basic teachings down. And from this teaching, we had the first stream winner, Anya Kondanya. So it's a very powerful teaching, obviously one of my favorites, and it has some great teachings, 4 Noble Truths, 8-fold Path. There's also other little nuggets of wisdom hidden in this. So this is the teaching today, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, turning the wheel of the Dhamma. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana. And Varanasi is Benares. These days it's called Varanasi. The B's and V's seem to become almost interchangeable. There the Blessed One addressed the monks of the group of 5 thus: Bhikkhus, these 2 extremes should not be followed by one who has gone forth from home to homelessness. What to? Now, I'll just do the translation here, but I'm going to pick it apart. The pursuit of sensual happiness and sensual pleasures, which is low, vulgar, the way of worldlings, ignoble, unbeneficial. And 2, the pursuit of self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, unbeneficial. These are the 2 extremes. So the first teaching the Buddha ever gave was the middle way between these 2. And those are the 2 extremes. Now, the first extreme, pursuit of sensual happiness and sensual pleasures. What does that mean? The Pali word is Kama Sukhalikanu Yoga. Anu Yoga literally means like 2 oxen which is tied together. That literally means what Anu Yoga. The word yoke in English, you know, comes from that yoga. It's something which you apply yourself to, you tie yourself to, and so the 2 tie together. So it literally does mean tying yourself to this type of practice. And what is that type of practice? Kamasukha Alika. And Kamasukha, the word karma, this is not the, unfortunately, it's, you can't hear the distinction between Pali. So there's 2 words which pronounce like karma, like the law of karma, the actions. And the other karma is kalong, A-M-A, karma. And it is a word which has no counterpart in the English language, because it does just refer to the world of the 5 senses as opposed to the realm of the mind. Now, of course, in the Western world, we just totally abandoned the idea of the mind being a separate world. And so, you know, we think of the world. So what we think of the world is this Kamaloka, the world of the 5 senses. But in Buddhism, it's understood there is the other world, the world of the mind. So this literally does mean Kamasukha, and Alika means like really, you can say pursuit, or infatuation with, or seeking of pleasure in the world of the five senses. So the pursuit of sensual happiness and sensual pleasures doesn't really, you know, sort of cut the mustard, as they say. It doesn't really get into the heart of that term. It does mean seeking happiness in the five sense world. And the word which is low, vulgar, the way of worldlings, ignoble, unbeneficial. You may like to know that the word low in English, again, that is not its real meaning, low. It is much worse than that. It means it's filthy, low, mean, vulgar. And the word is hina. And of course, you all know the word hina from the hinayana. The hinayana, the word hina is a very gross word. It's actually quite offensive. And if any of you are in the library, you can just go and look up the word hina in a Pali English dictionary, or even better, in the Sanskrit dictionary, and you hear all these incredibly bad words. It doesn't mean low. It means yucky, mean, coarse, ugly. Every sort of mean word comes in hina. So when it says the low here, it does really mean really sort of scraping the barrel type low. So this is, especially this is for one who's on the path of being enlightened, who's seeking sort of something much deeper. So the pursuit of pleasure in the five sense world, which is low, vulgar, the way of worldlings, ignoble, and that means an Arya, not part of the Aryan path. Noble is like the noble ones. And unbeneficial means it has nothing to do, it doesn't help the path to which a person is committed to becoming wise and enlightened. And that's the first one, basically the pursuit of pleasure in the five senses. And the second extreme is pursuit of, they say, self-mortification. But even that is a bit too limiting a translation of Atta Gilamata Nu Yoga. Again, Anu Yoga is a practice which you commit yourself to. And Atta Gilamata, Atta is the word same as Anatta, Atta, the self. Something which literally Gilamata means to tire, to weary, to exhaust yourself. These practices which really exhaust and tire yourself. It doesn't mean such extreme things as fasting or just meditating on anything which literally exhausts you. And that's a very beautiful nuance to that word and that particular part, because you know, to meditate you have to have energy, you have to have reasonably good health, whatever you can do to give that energy in the body so that you can transfer that into a bright mind. So Atta-Gana-Matanu Yoga would also include such things as not sleeping enough, or forcing the body until afterwards it gets weak and tired. That is also part of the extreme. So, and I'll say it again, Atta, you know, the self, it literally doesn't mean the metaphysical self, it just means, you know, the way you would use the word self in English, you know, that I'm looking after myself, I'm caring for myself. It just means, you know, this body-mind thing. And Atta Gilamata is actually to tire, to weary. So when you get that feeling for that word, it's the things which weary, which tired, which exhaust yourself, which take away the energy. That is one of the extremes. Obviously, if it is what they put here as self-mortification, of course that does weary you and tire you, makes you sick. But you know, that's just one part of what the Buddha meant by Atta Gilamata Nu Yoga. So those are the two extremes. And the Buddha says, without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata, which is how the Buddha always would call himself, and the Tathagata either means the thus come or the thus gone. You know, usually people say the thus gone or gone to thusness, has awakened to the middle way, which instead of giving rise to some which is noble, things which are unknowable, or low, vulgar way of worldlings, instead of giving way to things which are tiring, painful, ignoble, at least the way which the Buddha has woken up to gives rise to vision, gives rise to knowledge. It leads to peace, to direct knowledge and to enlightenment, to nirvana. So there is another way which doesn't give rise to tiredness, doesn't give rise to indulgence, gives rise to seeing, knowledge, peace. And the word for peace is upasama. It's a beautiful word. I mean, the mind being really still, at peace, and even amongst worldly turmoil. And the direct knowledge, which means like seeing it for yourself, not having to believe in it from others, but direct understanding, and to enlightenment and nirvana. And, of course, what is that middle way awakened to by the Buddha, which goes right to all these wonderful things, which leads to nirvana? And it is the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and of course, you know, I prefer right stillness to right concentration. That, monks, is the middle way awakened to by the Buddha, which gives rise to vision, which gives rise to knowledge, which leads to peace, the direct knowledge, to enlightenment and nirvana. You can see here he says this bhikkhus because he's talking to the five monks. So why do you think it's called right view or right stillness or right effort? That is because, and in all of these, there can be a way of even view, which is a wrong view, a wrong intention, a wrong speech. We all know examples of wrong speech. And even like wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, and wrong concentration, or wrong stillness. And of course, one of the examples of wrong stillness, you know, the type of stillness which has got nothing to do with the path, is... That's wrong stillness. In other words, you can still say it's still, but it's not going to be conducive to the path. And this is the Eightfold Path. Now, I'm going to pause there for any questions on the middle path. Please also understand why it was the Buddha's first teaching before he even got on to the Four Noble Truths. And of course, the reason was the history of the Buddha's search for enlightenment, 6 years of asceticism, 6 years of struggling. And then when he was getting nowhere with all of that hard work and effort, you know, he decided to take it easy. And when the five disciples saw that he wasn't apparently striving anymore, then they gave up on him. They thought he's given up the pursuit for enlightenment. And so they went their way, the Buddha went his way. And of course, the Buddha's way worked. And so the first teaching was telling them, said, look, all that striving which you and I were doing, now that is the Atagalamatana Yoga. Now that's the wrong path. Returning to the home and having all this sensuality, that is the wrong path. There's something in between there. It's not indulging in the senses, and it's not being cruel to your body. There's this beautiful middle way. And that is such incredible, powerful insight of the Buddha. And it's something which does distinguish Buddhism from other paths. Simplicity, but comfort of life. A middle way. Things which don't exhaust and tire you, make you sick, but not indulging either in the five senses. And I always mention the five senses because sometimes when you have happiness in the sixth sense, people think, oh, you get attached to that. That is not what the Buddha meant. If you get inspired by seeing a great act of kindness or generosity, then you allow yourself to enjoy that, because that's a joy of the mind. That inspires you and also increases your pursuit of the goal yourself. Things like inspiration, joy in listening to the Dhamma, just a wonderful sense of peace you get by keeping precepts. All of those things, and of course the joys of meditation, all of those things are not included in the extreme of someone who indulges in sensory pleasure. Because that sensory pleasure is only looking at the five senses. The sixth sense is exempted from the two extremes. Often the first extreme. Is that quite clear? So you can enjoy the pleasures of the mind, inspirations, wonderful acts of kindness which sometimes make you cry. That is part of the path. That is the middle way. Yes, John. I know that's another one which is often say that this is where we get the quote, the saying, thank God for Buddhism. And that came from this young monk, Kadipala, a long time ago, when I was explaining that a person who's just become enlightened, you can imagine, if anyone had a deep meditation, imagine how still and silent the mind would be. And basically that there would be no reason to teach. They're just so peaceful and still. You do need someone come from outside to boot up the system and just to get it going again. And that was, what's his name again? Brahma Sahampati, yeah. Now Brahma Sahampati was actually an old friend of the Buddha from the previous life as a monk under Kassapa. And if you look up Sahampati, and so he was actually not a Brahmin, he was an Anagami, a non-returner. So these were, in his previous life, the Buddha was a monk, a Jodipana, under Kassapa the Buddha. That's in the suttas. So is Sahampati being also a monk with the Buddha under Kassapa, previous life. So this Sahampati, he became an Anagami. And so, saw his old friend, being reborn as Siddhartha Gautama, and meditating under the Bodhi tree, got enlightened. And, he came down to congratulate his old mate. Well done, you're a Buddha. And that's where he asked him to teach. And now, Brahma, sometimes people, that's a word for a god. So sometimes in some translations they say the god, Sahampati. And it was the god Sahampati who just asked a question, teach. That's all that was needed, just to ask. Just like when the Buddha passed away, all that was needed was an answer, I'll live on a bit longer, and he would have. Just needed that little bit of seed intention from somebody else. So because, and I'm saying this is absolutely accurate, if Brahma Sahampati hadn't asked the Buddha to teach, he wouldn't have. He'd have been a Pacheka Buddha, a silent Buddha. So that's why we say, thank God for Buddhism. It's only a joke, because it's thank Anagami Sahampati for Buddhism. Okay, let's get going. I love those sorts of questions. Thank you, John. Okay. So, you said this is the middle way, the Eightfold Path. So anyone asks what is the middle way, it's the Eightfold Path, which leads to vision, gives to knowledge, leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana. So the Eightfold Path also has to be, avoiding those two extremes. The Eightfold Path is not ascetic. Should not be something which tires and exhausts you and makes you sick. If it is, it's not the Eightfold Path. It's not an Eightfold Path in which you indulge in the sense pleasures. Otherwise, it's not the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is the middle way. It's identical with the middle way. And so it has to be avoiding those two extremes. So when you're practicing the Eightfold Path, now if it's exhausting you, tiring you, giving you physical pain, then there's something there which is wrong. It can't be the middle way, it's Atta Gilamatanu Yoga. Or if you think, I can practice the Eightfold Path and still, watch my movies, have my sex, do whatever I like, then again, it's not the Eightfold Path. It has to be avoiding both extremes. So, and after elucidating the Eightfold Path as the middle way, then the Buddha goes on to the big teachings. Because remember, the context of the Buddha's search was specifically trying to find an end to suffering. Remember that classic tale of leaving the palace and seeing the old man, the sick man, the dead man, and then the monk, and just realizing just the predicament of life and that particular type of suffering. even though living in a palace with so much comforts and sensory pleasures, still the old age, sickness and death just put suffering into whatever he was doing. So he was trying to find a way out of that suffering. And so, suffering was, dukkha was the part of his pursuit, which is one of the reasons why he put his most powerful teachings in the form of the Four Noble Truths about suffering. So he said, now, this, monks, is the noble truth of suffering. Birth is suffering. I'll say it first of all, then, and I analyze afterwards. Aging is suffering, illness is suffering, death is suffering, union with what is displeasing is suffering, separation from what is pleasing is suffering, not to get what one wants is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. Now, first of all, now when I read this, I just stopped at the first one. Birth is suffering. That's actually the most profound of all of those. In other words, once you're born, you're stuffed. So don't think that somehow, as a human being, you're going to have a nice, happy life. Just by being born, you know, you've made a wrong decision. So when a person is born with these, you know, senses and bodies and mind, there's going to be a lot of difficulties for you. And of course you have the ordinary difficulties which people are coming next, you know, like old age and sickness. But, you know, sometimes we think, well, you know, if we're smart we can avoid those things. Jim Morrison, live fast, die young. He never sort of worried about old age because he died, was it 26 or 30 or something? So he's in all the doors. But that doesn't really work. But he said that illness is suffering, death is suffering. Now you get sort of what is really suffering, that union with what is displeasing is suffering. What, in other words, getting what you don't like is suffering. And of course, doesn't matter how wise you are, doesn't matter how skillful you are, doesn't matter how educated you are, or how powerful, even if you're the President of the United States, you still don't have the power to not be with what's suffering and displeasing. We often get what we don't like. And separation from what we do like is suffering. In other words, I know what I like. I know where I want to be, and I'm not there. It's suffering. So all of that, you can see, you know, is something which you just cannot control. And this is part of life. So we're often with what we don't like, and we're often separated from what we do like, is suffering. And sometimes they say here, they just put them all together. Not to get what one wants is suffering. And even, you notice, even just wanting, as soon as you want something, you are separated from what you like. The very act of wanting something is suffering. Because as soon as I want something, I'm here and I don't want to be here, I want something else, I want something more. So when you start wanting something, that's suffering until you either get what you want, so that particular suffering is relieved for a little while, or more than likely you don't get what you want. But if you do get what you want, it doesn't end there, you want something more. And that's the problem of life. So the wanting is a suffering. It means you have no peace. Exactly. In other words, to have the freedom from desire, not the freedom of desire. To want for nothing. It's a hard thing to do, to want for nothing. People try that and they meditate. And all these wants come up. There's a reason for that, but that's another talk. So, not to get what one wants is suffering. In brief, now the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. Now the five aggregates, this is one way of looking at the human body and mind as the physical body, that's rupa kanda, the vedana, which again hasn't got an English translation, it is a quality of pleasure, pain or in between with every one of the six senses. So beauty, ugliness with the sense of the eye, fragrance and stinky with the nose. So every particular sense has a different word for what is pleasurable and what is painful. But that affective quality which gives every sensory experience, pleasure or painful, in all its variable forms, that is what is called Vedana. And Sanya is the perception, which is why we look at a part of what we experience, and we say girl, boy, we say friend, enemy. This is the way we perceive the world. And much of that perception, again, is totally conditioned. And that's an important part of us. And then we have the sankhara. The most important part of sankhara is, this is the fourth canto, is chetana, otherwise known as the will, the choice. But the sankhara also includes things like emotions and thoughts. But in particular, the will. And lastly, vijnana, the last of the five khandhas, the five aggregates here, are consciousnesses. I always like to make it plural, because that is accurate to the Pali. It's not consciousness. You look it up, what it's explained, it's consciousnesses. Every one of the six senses has a different type of consciousness. And we always call it consciousness, singular, and that's one of the reasons why we mistake what's really going on. Consciousnesses. Six of them. And those are the five khandhas. So the Buddha is actually saying, these five khandhas are suffering. To have a body is suffering. And many of you will know that, especially if you're over 60 or 70. Actually, even if you're younger than that, it's still suffering. And Vedana, the pleasure and pain. Yeah, I like the pleasurable stuff, but I always get the painful stuff. I get a bit of each. Until you realize that all pleasure is just a space between two moments of suffering. All suffering is a space between two moments of pleasure. You can't have one without the other. So you can't just have all pleasure. Psychologically impossible. So because of that, that means Vedana is suffering. Sanya, perception. How hard is it? Someone was telling me about, their parents gave them a very hard time when they're young. And they're trying to forgive them, but it's so hard to do that. So hard to change a perception, which has been conditioned into you for such a long time. And that's why, people can actually spend a lot of money with psychologists who can change their perceptions. But it's tough work, changing, making them see not this way, but another way. And so perception's a lot of suffering. And of course, Chedana, I love this one, Chedana is suffering. And that's actually why you can't be still in meditation. There's something inside you, always makes you do something different, do something else. I call Chedana the sadistic prison guard, who never allows the prisoner, you, to be still for one moment. You're in your cell, and you're going to be still. Get out, go out, do this. You need something more, go and get that. And that Chedana, that will, it always give you a hard time until it totally stops. And then you have some pleasure. And of course, the emotions, a lot of suffering. Yes, it'd be nice if we always have lovely emotions. But that can't be done. Anicca, they change. And lastly, consciousnesses. Consciousnesses, the six of them, are suffering. It says that specifically. When I saw the Buddha say that, I thought, wow, that's neat. The reason is because they're irritations of the mind. To see is an irritation. To hear. Have you ever gone into the shopping mall? I had to go into the shopping mall about 2 months ago. What was it to do? I was trying to go to the post office, I think. Or to do something in Rockingham. Oh, I hate going into shopping centres. The sights are just so coarse. And I don't know about you, maybe because I spent too much time in a monastery and just a very peaceful mind. But sure, the sights there, the impingement on the eyes, is just so much suffering. And also sometimes when you live in a very peaceful place and then you hear sort of loud noise, that is just suffering as well. And you can understand that all of the sensory impingements, they are just like that. They're disturbances of the beautiful stillness. If peace is the highest happiness, you can understand why consciousness is suffering. and to be still. And the consciousness is disappearing one by one. Oh, that's so much bliss. So anyway, that's one of the reasons why people go to sleep is bliss. Do you enjoy going to sleep at night? Because much of your consciousness is taken away. So that's one of the reasons why the five aggregates are suffering. Now they say here the five aggregates subject to clinging. This is called upadana, panchupadana kanda. And that causes a lot of problems for people. They think, oh, as long as you've got no clinging, the five khandhas are okay. In another sutra, the Buddha said, the five khandhas and the five khandhas affected by clinging are one and the same. You're not really different. The only reason they say, it's not clinging is the wrong word here as well. The word should be like fuel. It's upadana. Upadana means also it's a fuel. And they use this, the best simile is a candle, upadana's the wax. The electric light, upadana's the electricity. It takes up, it sucks up the electricity, sucks up the wax, you know, to give it fuel, you know, to continue on. So the last lot of khandhas are the fuel for this present khandha. Now this is where this present set of khandhas come from the previous ones. They cause it, they fuel it. That's why they're called upadana khandhas. They're just here right now, and these khandhas right now, you know, your body, your what's it called, vedana, your perceptions, your jhana, your consciousnesses, these are causing the next ones. So they're fuel as well as results. Yes.
So what is the work of the mind that returns to the source? Is it yoni manasikara? With respect to the five khandhas, how do they fit together? What is the work that to be done there?
Well, again, the manasikara, I would try and give it a special meaning, but manasikara means just the work of the mind, like how you use your mental faculties. And most importantly, the yonisa, where it comes from, the causes of what happens. The whole of Buddhism is all about, we've got suffering. Why? What causes this? Where does it come from? So we've got consciousness. Where does it come from? How does it arise? So this is like yonisa. So a lot of times people actually look at the consequences of things. Well, here I am now, just how am I going to get out of this? And instead of saying, how did I get into this in the first place? So how we got into this, that's going backwards to the cause of things, the origin of things. And that particular point was made to me so well in an introductory essay by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, where he made this very beautiful distinction, which when I got it, I thought, wow, that just explains so much of Buddhism, between Dhamma and its opposites of Atta. Like you've got happiness, suffering, you've got light, dark. The word Dhamma has an opposite. And it's not sort of stupidity or anything. Dhamma is the cause of things, where things come from. The origin of things, the source, what, the why. And the Atta is the where to. Where does this all lead to? And those two are just antonyms. When you get that idea, you understand why the commentaries are called Atta Gata, the verses of the meaning, where it all leads to. And the explanations. But the Dhamma is the source of everything. One Dhamma, one idea, which is the source of where we're from and why we have these sufferings. That's why they have the Four Noble Truths, some which is a source, like a law of physics, like a law of the mind. And from that law of physics, the law of the mind, you can work out how the whole universe evolves.
So does it essentially involve the paying of attention back into yourself in the moment of meditation, and I guess trying to understand the actions and consequences outside of meditation? Is that the story?
It is that and much more. For example, in the old Satipatthana Sutras, they have something there, the arising and passing away of stuff. Now, of course, that has been misinterpreted, and if you actually look closer into the sutras, Satipatthana Sangyutta, it said absolutely so clearly, the whole sutra on arising and passing away, what it means is, what causes these things to arise? Where do they come from? The passing away is what causes these things to disappear. So even in the Satipatthana, it's like seeing the causes of things. And why do they disappear? Now that is the Yonisa Manasikara. So, you know, you have some suffering, some grief, or even some thought in the meditation. Why? So you don't look at the thought and try and get rid of it, because it'll just come back again. Why do you have that thought to begin with? Why were you disturbed? So that is Yonisa. You go backwards into the causes of things. That's seeing the arising. And it happens in meditation. Sometimes you have a very peaceful meditation. Everything subsides. Afterwards, why? What was the cause of the good meditations? That is Yonisa Manasikara. When you're really happy. There's all sorts of different types of happiness in the world. And when you're really happy, really content, those high moments of your life, why? And that's actually, you find out that, as you were saying, these are moments of deep contentment. And you notice that that's when the desires and wants temporarily vanish. You didn't want anything in the whole world. And that's the Yonisa Manasikara, to see the cause of your good happiness.
Thank you, Bhante. Bhante, one more question.
Yeah.
Thoughts in the mind, emotions in the mind, sankharas, I guess, yeah. Is what you're talking about. They exist in the context of a background when you're watching the mind in meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Is that background an appearance to the mind, or is it something that leads down deep into the source of...
The background is a good perception. So it's just a perception which we can make up, which helps us. It's a useful one, in the sense that it's not inherent. But what it does mean, if you see the background as well as the thoughts, you don't get sucked into the thoughts as the only thing.
Do we make the background as well as the thoughts?
Of course you do, yes.
So that when consciousness, when you become very, very still, that too disappears?
Absolutely. That's ekagata.
Thank you.
Nothing left, just one. So, anyway, that's the truth of suffering. Now, of course, as you're saying, Yonisa Manasikara, where does it come from? That's the second noble truth. So you understand what suffering is, but why? And something a bit more deeper than just getting born. Actually, what it was, actually, why we get born. This, monks, is the noble truth of the origin of suffering, the cause. It is this craving, this wanting, this lack of contentment, which leads to renewed existence. And people who say that, Buddhism doesn't teach rebirth, it's a renewed existence, it's a renewed birth. Renewed existence, rebirth, where's it gone? It is this craving which leads to rebirth or renewed existence. That craving is a cause of suffering. In other words, you're born, you can't get rid of the suffering except by making sure you don't get born again. So the cause of suffering is the craving, the wanting, which gets you reborn. And I've just finished the last bit of the paragraph. And that craving is accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight now here, now there. And in essence, it is the three cravings. The cravings for sensory pleasure, that's only one of them, which causes wanting. And the craving to be, to exist, that's the best one. Because even if people haven't got any sensory pleasures, you know, they're old and they're dying, still they'd rather be with pain than not be at all. It is because of the fear. We don't know anything except being. And our last thing we'll ever defend is our existence. It is, but the way you overcome that is really neat. The only way I know you have to overcome that is you get into such deep meditation you start to disappear. And that's always scary, when parts of who you think you are, you know, fall away. But what overcomes the fear is the sheer pleasure. You're vanishing, you're disappearing. But it's so beautiful. It's really cool to vanish. So what the hell, I'm going for it. That's basically what happens. So anyway, the the craving to be. And of course, that is a powerful one. And the last one is, it is a part of the craving to be, which is a craving for extermination. It's a me trying to kill myself. It is what I, using a quote from Oliver Twist, it's like a man trying to eat his own head. Which is a beautiful quote from Oliver Twist, you know, from Charles Dickens. Trying to imagine a man eating his own head. You know, you can't get rid of yourself because you are trying to do it. So the craving to get nibbana, to extinguish yourself, to euthanize yourself, will never work. You sort of almost got it, but you know, you're going about it the wrong way. It's another sense of I wanting something. Okay, you got the microphone. Oh, yeah. Sorry? A craving. I think it's probably because beings craved. The first being. They always say that the first being is not the one who created the universe. The first person who arose in this universe, they say, it's a very fascinating argument. The Buddha said, oh, the first being arose in the universe, there's no one here before me. Here's this universe, I must have created it. I must have made it. So it was a God expanded the universe. But the God is not the firstborn. It's just the first person. Yeah. So it always keeps expanding, simply because people keep doing too much.
That's what actually happens when you do meditation. If you've got reasonably good focus, attention. When you focus your attention on knowing,
yeah,
you turn your mind, your attention back on the experience of knowing.
Yeah.
After a while, what my personal experience of this is a disintegration. My sense of self just starts to slowly disintegrate. Who's doing the practice slowly disintegrates and it goes to deeper and deeper levels of stillness. But it's kind of like having a mini nervous breakdown. I've said that to you before.
It's
okay. It's not like it's both scary and blissful at the same time.
Yeah. But it's very scary, and that's why many people stop. So they'd rather exist and have suffering than actually disappear. You know how I teach, and I teach straight from the suttas. When I say, oh, what happens after an arahat disappears? They've gone. That's negative. That's cold. I don't want to do that. So fair enough, but that's what happens. And after a while, when you've had enough, then you also want to poof out of existence. I mean, a real emptiness. You've got to not, like the Mahayana say, the emptiness of emptiness. Not even emptiness is left. The emptiness is scary, but it's blissful. Don't you like going to the ocean and seeing just the ocean with no ships on there? Totally empty. Or going out and seeing the stars at night and going to places between the stars where there's nothing. Vast emptiness. To me, it's really cooling and peaceful. So, different perceptions. That's why in the hall, I gave a talk about space 2 weeks ago. In this hall here, there's not very much, many things. We don't have photos and paintings on the walls. We don't have, the Buddha's enlightenment on the ceiling, like on the Sistine Chapel. You know, it's just a white wall on the top, white ceiling. Just a dull carpet. That's on purpose. To try and keep it empty. As best we possibly can. To celebrate space. People boring. To me, liberating. Anyway, let's go to the third noble truth. So, the origin of suffering is the craving which leads to renewed existence. Now, the noble truth of the cessation of suffering, it is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving, the craving which leads to renewed existence. When that stops, fades away, remainderless, nothing left, then that is the end of suffering. And how is that done? It is the giving up, relinquishing it, freedom from it, non-reliance of it. And those are the four ways of letting go, which I've given a whole talk on. Chaga. And if you want to know what chaga is, look at the monk next to me. His name is Venerable. Chaga. And chaga is like literally giving up. Giving a donation. You don't expect anything in return. Meditating. Not expecting anything in return for giving an hour to meditation. Going on a retreat, not expecting results. What Ajahn Chah used to say, you meditate to let go, not to gain things. It's a chaga, it's a giving away. You've got enough stuff already, so you're empty, giving away. That's chaga. Pati Nisaga is literally chucking away, throwing away. Just like on, I don't know what day, you get your rubbish bins taken away by the council. But it's like putting all your rubbish. And wouldn't it be wonderful if someone could take it away? If we had a box or a big bin at the Buddhist Society where you can put your defilements every week and we can get sort of Lynn to take them away or whoever else is the caretaker. That's Pati Nisaga, throwing things away. It's a bit more aggressive than just giving. Oh yeah, Roman Catholic confession, but sometimes that's good. No jokes, Ajahn Brahm, because I've got lots of jokes about Catholic confession. That's just a marvellous area for jokes. Anyway, throw things away. And the next one is, what is it? Chaga, Pati Nisaga, Muti. And that's freedom. And I think the best example I had about that is, you know, the difference between being in a monastery and being in prison. And the only difference is, because actually physically, even you go on a retreat, it's not as comfortable as in prison. You know, this ask this guy next to me, how many meals do you get in prison? Three or four, five? Three, but you can get stuff in the afternoon and stuff. Breakfast, lunch and dinner, and you get your own TV set and you get all sorts of other stuff. And when you get all that stuff, we don't get that in monastery. So why do people like coming to monasteries or even to retreat centres? And if you really wanted to have a much happier time, instead of going on the 9-day retreat, go to the 9-day prison sentence. Well, the only reason is because if you want to be there, you don't want to be there. There's a wonderful insight there. Any place you don't want to be is a prison. If you don't want to be here, you get bored, or it's too hot, or you're tired, you're aching. Oh, I want this to finish so I can go home. Then this place, this hall, is a prison. And I know that because, you know, I travel around, I have an interesting life. Sometimes you go into 5-star hotels. Once I went to a 6-star hotel in Japan. 6-star. I hated it. I was in this room, had all these incredible things, jacuzzis and TV sets and mini bars, which I couldn't use. And, you know, I wanted to go outside, have a walk, but the host said, no, you've got to stay inside because we know where you are. And to me, it was a prison. And I thought, amazing. You can actually experience a 6-star hotel room as a prison. And it's only because I didn't want to be there. And when I realized that, I said, oh, okay, this is good enough. I can meditate here. It's quiet. It's got a nice aircon. So I could use that. So I changed it from being a prison to be like being a kuti in a monastery, just by changing perception. But I noticed that any place you can make a prison if you want to be somewhere else. And freedom, being free, is wanting to be wherever you are, not wanting to be somewhere else. That's letting go. So I always say that in meditation, if you're having you're dull and sleeping, I don't want to be sleepy, I want to be in jhanas, then that is not letting go. I'm happy to be sleepy. I'm happy to have my mind being all over the place. If you're happy to be here, then you're free. Then you're letting go. And the last one, Analia, is literally does mean Alia. You know that word from Himalaya. There's also another state in East India, Meghalaya. Alia, Himalaya, is the place where the snows settle. Hima is snow, Alia, the place where snows settle. So Alia is where something settles, where it finds a roosting, like a bird at night finds a roosting on a tree. That's Alia. And An-Alia is where there's no place it can settle. There's no place anything can stick. That is the fourth way of letting go. So the simile in the Buddha is having like a place, a mind like a lotus flower. Urinate on it, the urine just falls off, it doesn't leave any residue. You can't smell it afterwards. Or you pour, you know, some perfume on the lotus, and it just all runs off, and you can't smell the perfume afterwards. So pleasures and pains, praise and blame, it all falls off you. You have a mind which nothing settles. It is an-alaya. That's the other way of letting go. And it's incredible, there's little four little things there. Sometimes you just pass over them, but there's a whole Dhamma teachings just in those four little words. That is the end of suffering. You know, just giving away things. Doing something, not expecting anything back. You know, giving someone a gift, giving someone a lift back home. You don't expect thanks, you don't expect anything at all. You just give for the sake of giving. It's letting go. Throwing away possessions, mental possessions, meditation possessions, physical possessions. Throwing things away. And just wanting to be here. Wherever that happens to be, even if you're sick and dying. Wanting to be here. Actually, I've just... Hopefully Ainsley and Barbara listen to this. Barbara told me a nice little story, anecdote, today at lunchtime. She was visiting England, one of Ainsley's old mates from Malaysia. You know, really, really old age, sick, having to be hoisted, you know, to get into a chair, have to have his bum wiped, incontinent at both ends, she said. And he was really suffering. And Barbara reminded her, look, just say, this is good enough. You know, you've got a place to stay, a nice bed, people looking after you, they're being kind to you, you've got food, and the air con to keep you warm or cold. Just keep saying to yourself, good enough, this is good enough, this is good enough. And this poor guy in the hospital, you got it. He's like, yeah, you're right. This is good enough. And 2 days later, he died. Good enough, just in time. So he's a very fortunate man to get that teaching, just at the right time. That means you're letting go. You're not fighting. It's good enough. So that is the way to Nibbana. The ending of craving. And the noble truth, the last one, of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Yeah, you can get there, but how do you actually learn how to give up, not expecting things in return? How do you learn how to be able to feel free wherever you happen to be? It takes a training, a practice, and that's the Noble Eightfold Path. This is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering, the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention. I always love just pausing on right intention because that is so overlooked. Intentions of letting go, nekama, of kindness, avayapada, and of gentleness. And I love emphasizing that because it's usually passed over. The intentions of, you're doing this to let go of stuff, not to gain things. Of kindness, compassion. Just basic Buddhism, which sometimes people forget, and they just go hitting each other over the back in retreats. Ooh. And gentleness. Take your time, be gentle. It's not a warrior type religion. Yes. Yes, right intention, always. Letting go of the world. Being kind to yourself and kind to the world. Being gentle. That was always typical Buddhism, what it was known for in history. Sometimes people forget that. That's why sometimes meditation is one thing and the Buddhist practice outside in the world is another thing. No, they go together. And where were we? The right intention. Then right speech, action, livelihood. It's important. You have to keep your virtue. And the right effort, right mindfulness and right stillness. The Eightfold Path. That's the way of letting go. of craving. So those eight factors, they should put them in the context. This should be lessening your craving, not making more craving. Otherwise it's not right. It should be done under the umbrella of throwing things away, of the sense of freedom, being happy to be here wherever you happen to be, and also of being someone to which nothing sticks, especially no attainments stick to you. So, there we go, the Four Noble Truths. It's a brilliant teaching, you can go on forever on those ones, that's the essence. And now we get a little summary. This is the noble truth of suffering. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, true knowledge, and light. And so just saying that, you know, he understood the noble truth of suffering. He also understood the noble truth of suffering is to be fully understood. The most important word is fully. It's actually pari nyayam. Nyaya means to know. Pari means fully, like the difference between nibbana and parinibbana. Nibbana is this thing ceasing. Parinibbana means totally, fully, 100% nibbana ceased. It needs to be fully understood. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, true knowledge, and might. And now the Buddha says his great statement, this noble truth of suffering has been fully understood. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, true knowledge, and might. And elsewhere the Buddha made this great saying, the only reason why people aren't enlightened is because they haven't fully understood suffering. 90%, 99%, 99.9% is not enough. It has to be the fully understood suffering. There's always one little part of you, of life, of the universe, which you think everywhere else, yeah, is suffering. But I've got my, what I call the ultimate retirement home of you, the place where you can escape from suffering. You don't give suffering to that place. That's the reason why people don't get enlightened, because they haven't fully seen that the whole lot is suffering. It's like having an apple. Yeah, you know most of it is rotten, but you think I can cut the rotten part away and keep the good part. You haven't fully understood that the whole of the apple is rotten. It's only when the whole of the apple fully seen as rotten, you throw the whole lot away. And you are part of that apple. So when it comes to all the rotten apples in a Buddhist society, we're all rotten apples, me included, sorry. Of course it's overwhelming. This is stuff which kicks you up the backside and turns you upside down. And wow, this is no simple stuff. You know, when you start to sort of contemplate this, oh, this is revolutionary. But you know, it's what the Buddha said. And sometimes you see what the Buddha said, crikey, you don't mince his words. But the point is that once you see it and start doing this, you're free, you're happy. And that's the nice thing about seeing sort of monks and nuns, people who've done it. You know, it's pretty, you know, they're not depressed people. Actually, they're pretty happy and just having a good time. So it's a good advert for doing this, seeing someone like an Ajahn Chah. Well, if that's, you know, what happens if I do all this stuff, yeah, it's scary and a bit overwhelming, but if that's where I end up, yeah, I'm going for it. And the noble truth of the origin of suffering. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, true knowledge, and light. So we understood the noble truth, the origin of suffering. And the noble truth, the origin of suffering, is to be abandoned. Thus, because in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, true knowledge, and light, the noble truth, the origin of suffering, has been abandoned. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, true knowledge, and light. Does that mean you have to abandon the noble truth? Of course, when it says the noble truth of the cause of suffering, that means the craving. So he said the craving which gives renewed existence, that is what has to be abandoned. So sometimes when you translate word for word, you miss the meaning. What has to be abandoned is the craving. What do you want craving for? Let it go. The next one, a noble truth of the cessation of suffering. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, true knowledge, and light. And the noble truth of the cessation of suffering is to be realized. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, true knowledge, and light. The noble truth of the cessation of suffering has been realized. Thus, because in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, true knowledge, and light. So, you know, the cessation of suffering, you know, nirvana, has to be realized. And realized means experienced for yourself. Not just understood, but realized, got there. Done it, craving is gone. And lastly, the noble truth of the way leading to cessation of suffering. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, true knowledge, and light. The noble truth of the way leading to cessation of suffering is to be developed. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, true knowledge, and light. And the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering has been developed. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, true knowledge, and light. That's the bhavana. You may have heard of like Bhavana Society, that's Bhante-ji's organization. You know, when we had Santi Monastery, you know, when I was in charge of it, I called it Chitta Bhavana. When people asked me, you know, what do I teach Samatha Vipassana, I said, I don't teach either, I teach Bhavana. It's a development of the Eightfold Path, which is more than just meditation. It's developing your precepts, the right speech, action, livelihood, developing your views. So it's the development of the whole path. So that's, the Buddha said, it is to be developed. He has developed it. It's done. And so long, monks, as my knowledge and vision of these Four Noble Truths, as they really are in their three phases, knowing what they are, knowing what's to be done with them, and knowing you've done what has to be done with them. Like the first noble truth, I know the truth, and it is to be fully understood, and I have fully understood it. That's the, you know, the three ways. As long as these four noble truths, as they really are in the three phases and 12 aspects, 4 times 3 is 12, as long as I was not thoroughly purified in this way, I did not claim to have awakened to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment in this world. With its devas, maras, and brahmas, in this generation, with its ascetics and brahmins, its devas and humans, in other words, with the world as it was known at that time. But when my knowledge and vision of these Four Noble Truths, as they really are in their three phases and 12 aspects, was thoroughly understood, was thoroughly purified in this way, then I claim to have awakened to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment in this world. This day was Miles and Brahmins, in this generation with its ascetics, Brahmins, its devas and humans. The knowledge and vision arose in me. Unshakable is the liberation of my mind. This is my last birth. There is no more renewed existence. That's a great claim of the Buddha's enlightenment. And so, first of all, I point out, he always says, when I came to have awakened to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment, usually pointing out because you know that sometimes, like in every spiritual group, you know, we have trying to outdo your neighbors. And sometimes I've actually seen this written in some books by not all parts, but some parts of Mahayana who say, well, if once you're fully enlightened, just like a Buddha, you can actually practice a bit more and become a bodhisattva. And, you know, that's yucky. That's always like been a one-upmanship, which is not part of being a Buddhist. But the Buddha says, unsurpassed. Can't go further than this. So that's important. And also, what is enlightenment, the liberation of the mind? This is my last birth. There is no more renewed existence. So after the Buddha passes away, that's it, gone. So you can't say that after the Buddha passed away, he exists in some realm somewhere. No more existence. We know that sometimes people would say that. They would say the Buddha is no more, but Jesus Christ is alive. And the answer to that, he said, no, you don't understand. You can see the Buddha today. How can you see the Buddha today when the Buddha disappeared? The Buddha doesn't exist anymore, but there's a famous saying, he or she who sees the Buddha sees a Dhamma. She who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. Can you see the Dhamma today? Yes. So you can see the Buddha. A different idea of what the Buddha is. Not the person, that's gone. But what distinguishes that being from all other beings? The Dhamma. That you can see today. That never dies. Da da da. So the Buddha lives. Okay. Okay, Chris, what have I said now? Okay, good. Jesus has got into the phone. What can I say?
You'll get strung up one of these days, Bhante. Bhante, is the causal conditions for a bodhisattva a Buddha, and then someone asks him to teach? Is that how it works? Because that's how it worked with the Buddha.
But a Pacheka Buddha also doesn't come back again. They're not a bodhisattva.
So what's the causal conditions for a bodhisattva? That is an arahat who decides to teach. In fact, the Buddha was a bodhisattva. I mean, he stuck around for 35 years.
Now you're making a very good point. The meaning of a bodhisattva is someone who sacrifices themselves for all other beings. And an arahat is the best of those. They're the ones who actually know what they're talking about and the ones who can help other people the most. I often say that, say, if I have a heart condition and if I have an operation, I want a graduate cardiologist, not a student, to cut me open and do a heart operation. I want someone who's graduated. So if you want to teach, you want someone, at least an Aryan, to teach you, not someone who hasn't been enlightened yet. And a bodhisattva is, by definition, unenlightened. They put off their enlightenment to help others. So they're like the student doctors. Basically, they don't know really what they're doing. They've got good hearts, good intentions, but not enough wisdom.
I think there's a bit of terminology here,
indeed. But the real bodhisattva, in the sutras, you'll find the word bodhisattva only occurs related to Siddhartha Gautama after his birth, actually just before his birth, when he descended from the Tusita heaven up until his enlightenment. That's the only time he called himself a bodhisattva.
Thank you.
No, he wasn't called a bodhisattva. No. He never called himself. You have the Gatikara Sutta. That's the sutra in Majjhima Nikaya, Gatikara. I forget now, 50-something. That is where the Buddha recalls his previous life, Anakasapa, as the Brahmin Jyotipala. Never calls himself a bodhisattva in that sutra. The only time you see the word bodhisattva in the sutras is when you're talking about the Buddha from descent from the Tusita realm into his mum's body and then up to the time of his enlightenment. Yeah. The Jatakas are not really part of the sutras. They were known to be added a long time afterwards. There are some Jatakas who are actually in the sutras. That is one of them. Jatakas means previous life stories. And that is one which is authentic because that was actually in the sutras. What we know as the Jatakas today, every scholar understands, they've been added to, there are a lot of myths and stories from ancient days. And of course the hero was always called the Buddha in a previous life. Okay. So unshakable is the liberation of my mind. This is my last birth. Now there is no more renewed existence. This is what the Blessed One said. Elated, the bhikkhus of the group of five delighted in the Blessed One's statement. It's all right to delight in the Dhamma. So don't think, oh, I'm delighting, I must be making a mistake. Let go of your attachment to listen to the Dhamma. This is a happiness of the mind, to be encouraged. They delighted in what the Blessed One had said. And while this discourse was being spoken, there arose in the Venerable Kondanya the dust-free, stainless vision of the Dhamma. In other words, he saw it. And this is the expression of entering the stream, becoming the first Aryan after the Buddha. Whatever is subject to origination, all of that is subject to cessation. Whatever arises is going to cease totally. What did he particularly mean? All these five khandhas. The body is subject to cessation, yeah, most people know that. The Vedana, perception, yeah, okay. Will, subject to cessation. And the six consciousnesses, including the mind consciousness, is subject to stop. It's not eternal. There's not a soul there which is going to last forever. It's all subject to cessation. Seeing the great emptiness, there's nothing there. That's why when you see there's nothing there, it's no longer scary. You're not losing anything, because you never had anything to begin with. So, and when the wheel of the Dhamma had been set in motion by the Blessed One, here they call it the wheel of the Dhamma. And a wheel is something which keeps rolling, rolling. And this is the reason why it's called the wheel of the Dhamma teaching. When the wheel of the Dhamma had been set in motion by the Blessed One, the earth-dwelling devas raised a cry. They have all these different levels of beings which were in the Buddhist cosmology at that time, and are probably mostly here today. The earth-dwelling devas, you may call them the fairies or something, raised a cry. At Varanasi, in the deer park at Isipatana, the unsurpassed wheel of the Dhamma has been set in motion by the Blessed One. This is the great part, which cannot be stopped by any ascetic or Brahmin or Deva or Mara or Brahma or by anyone in the world. As I see these days, the genie is out of the bottle. Can't be put back in again. The truth is out there. Who said that? Something that was ex-Mara. Okay, this is Buddhism. So it can't actually be hidden anymore. It can't be stopped. And it's a beautiful thing because it hasn't been stopped. 2600 years, still going. It's in Australia, all over the world. Crikey. Can't be stopped. Having heard that cry, by any ascetic Brahma, Deva, Mara, or God, or by anyone in the world, having heard the cry of the earth-dwelling devas, the devas of the realm of the four great kings, they go up every level, heard a cry, at Varanasi, the unsurpassed wheel of the Dhamma had been set in motion by the Blessed One, which cannot be stopped by anyone in the world. Having heard the cry of the devas of the realm of the four great kings, the next level, the Tara Tingsa devas, the next level, the Yama devas, the next level, the Tusada devas, the next level, the Manavati devas, the next level, the Paranimitta Wasawati devas, and the next level, the devas of Brahma's company, and that's where Brahma's Hampati was. So he heard that the Buddha got enlightened, that's why he came and congratulated him and asked him to teach. And it's interestingly, in the Paranimitta Wasawati devas, the head honcho, the chief of that realm, is none other than Mara. That's where Mara hangs out, the realm which controls other beings. I call him the control freak in chief. So when he heard the Buddha got enlightened, he went down, not to ask him to teach, but the total opposite. Don't teach, there's too much problems and difficulty. You know, you go and teach and people won't understand and they'll criticize you and they'll ask you all these questions and they'll do this and all that. Well, it's a waste of time. Just forget it. Just enjoy yourselves. Mara did that to make sure that no one else got out of samsara. And the Buddha said, no, I will not leave. I will teach. That was after Brahmasampati. I think Brahmasampati got there first. Mara came there afterwards. And Brahmasampati said, the Buddha replied, I will not leave samsara until I have created the four assemblies of monks, of bhikkhunis, of lay men and lay women, until they're flourishing, strong, many enlightened. Once I've done that, then I will leave. And I love saying that because that was from the very first weeks of enlightenment. The Buddha put out his plan for his rest of his life to make bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, lay men, lay women, good Buddhists. And it's only later on, 3 months before his enlightenment, he said, well, done that now. Lots of bhikkhus, lots of bhikkhunis, lots of lay men, lots of lay women, many enlightened, so I can go now, I've done my job. So, that was actually said to Mara. And Brahma's company raised the cry, at Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana, the unsurpassed wheel of the Dharma has been set in motion by the Blessed One, which cannot be stopped by any ascetic or Brahmin or Deva or Mara or Brahma or by anyone in the world. So on that point, I've already mentioned bhikkhunis, you know that there is a saying, people actually doubt whether this is real, where he said, if you ordain bhikkhunis, the good Dharma will only last 500 years. But, he just said here, once the wheel of Dharma is set in motion, it can't be stopped. It can't be stopped by anybody, not even bhikkhunis. So there's, you know, a little bit of a sort of suspiciousness given to that saying, it lasts only 500 years. Once it's out there, it can't be stopped by anybody. Thus, at that moment, at that instant, at that second, the cry spread as far as the Brahma world, and this 10,000-fold world system shook, quaked, and trembled, and an immeasurable glorious radiance appeared in the world, surpassing the divine majesty of the Devas. Whereas, Peter's over here, he was talking about the 8 reasons for earthquakes in the world. And one of them is like a Buddha appearing, and sometimes there must be, when an arahat sometimes appears, there must be many, many enlightened beings in Indonesia and also in Japan, where all the earthquakes are. No, that's only a joke, sorry. I forget about that. I'm going to get strung up again. And then the Blessed One uttered this inspired utterance, because he knew, mind reading, that Kondanya, this monk, had understood that all that's subject to arising is subject to ceasing, disappearing totally. Kondanya has indeed understood, seen the Dhamma. Kondanya has indeed understood. So he gave this incredible teaching, realized someone had understood it. In this way, the Venerable Kondanya acquired the name Anya Kondanya. Kondanya, who has understood. So, does anyone want to be called Anya Chris? Anya Hugh? Anya Lynn? Anya anyone? Anya John? And that's the first teaching, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Any last questions? Yeah. I think it's more of a metaphor, you know, because otherwise you're saying about if earthquakes in this religion, other religions always say great earthquakes happened. And even in English we say it's an earth-shattering event. You know, the West Coast Eagles won the Premiership. It was an earth-shattering event. And the earth doesn't get shattered. Yeah, it doesn't. So I think it's more likely to be a metaphor. Because otherwise, every time someone got enlightened, there'd be so much destruction. The kings and people say, look, please don't get enlightened. Or go somewhere else to get enlightened, not in our city, because we can't always... You're dying right, always rebuilding all the towns and places and the roads. I agree with you there. Ah, the radiance, yeah. And that's an interesting... Is that a metaphor, just... Sometimes when incredible events happen, you know, you think that maybe there is this, the mind creates a great psychic light, a flash of light. Yeah, maybe so those people who are a little bit sensitive can actually see a light. Wow. What's the difference sometimes between the mental world and the physical world? The mental world governs the physical world. Yeah.
Oh, John, just a couple of questions. Is the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path carried on through all Buddhist traditions?
All Buddhist traditions? No, you put the question the other way around. Anywhere where the Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path are carried on, that is called a Buddhist tradition.
So Mahayana, all the branches of Mahayana follows the same?
If they are following the Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path, they are our Buddhist tradition. It doesn't matter, many people in Theravada don't follow the Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path. many people in Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana, Kahayana, whatever yana. So this is actually us based on the Buddha's answer to the monk Upawana in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. So in other religions, can people get enlightened? And the Buddha gave a brilliant answer. Where they follow the Eightfold Path, they now get enlightened. Doesn't matter what you call yourself. Doesn't matter what color robes you wear, what gender you are, what sexual orientation you are, what race you are, how old you are, how young you are. It's what you do. If you follow the Eightfold Path, then you'll get enlightened.
Yeah, what I mean is it actually taught as what's in here?
Ah, taught. It really, that's an interesting one because there's always movements, I see, in all parts of Buddhism to go back to the early teachings of Buddhism. Now, that group in Japan, which I went to in early December, that's one of the main reasons I volunteered to go there. Because they said they saw the decline of Buddhism in Japan, and they wanted to bring it back to the early traditions of Buddhism. And there was a group in Thailand, a monk who stayed here for a few months. We have something in common. He was also expelled from Wat Bapong, that's Ajahn Kukrit. And he's becoming quite popular in Thailand now by just going back to, he calls it Buddha Wachana, in other words of the Buddha. Now, trying to get back to the original teachings. So in all types of Buddhism, sometimes we always tend to drift away from the original teachings. And there's always movements in all parts of Buddhism to come back to the original teachings. And everybody agrees that the original teachings are Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path. That is understood by all traditions.
And the Pali Canon?
The Pali Canon, most people, yeah, they say the Pali Canon, the Dvipitaka, not the Tripitaka. Abhidharma is added.
Ajahn, second question is, world systems that are hundreds and thousands of light years from here, can there be another Buddha up here?
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, why not? Because my understanding of a Buddha is like the once, you know, the Buddhism sort of vanishes little by little, can't be stopped, it just fades away. So once it fades away by anicca, then someone else comes along, an arahat, becomes enlightened. Usually, like the Buddha, a once returner gets reborn, gets enlightened in this life. And then once it gets enlightened in this life, someone will teach. And the first arahat which teaches is a Buddha. So yeah, of course, why not? Another interesting question, because Cecilia was talking about cyborgs. Can artificial intelligence be enlightened? Can an artificial intelligence practice the Eightfold Path? Can that be a vehicle for people to become enlightened? And that answer to that question will be answered at the conference, which is coming in August. Please buy your tickets as soon as possible if you're interested in the answer. Okay, it's time for actually to come to the conference.
Yes.
An untold, unspecified number. I don't know. For lots. But anyway, I think we better go now because my lift is waiting. So thank you all for listening to the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Please take this back with you because it's a great sutra. If you don't need it, you can give it to Lynn and Lynn will have to shred it because you can't throw this in the bin. It's an important sutra. Oh, yeah. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantā abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi suppatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sango Sangang Namami.
And please excuse me for rushing off, but I've got a nephew coming from England.
I'm meeting him at 5:30.